I'm very pleased to have our next speaker here. We were able to secure him from the National Groundwater Association. He is this year's McElhaney Distinguished Lecturer and has been spending the earlier part of this year and will continue touring the country this year, giving his presentation on treatment technologies for advanced filtration products that purify water and make it much more suitable for various uses. And he's able to speak on a large variety of contaminants that might need to be removed. And I think especially important to us here in Minnesota, as Anita mentioned early this morning, we're a cold weather region, and so we also have cold water. And so we have a distinct problem of needing to de-ice our roads, and a lot of times that's by the use of road salt. And because of that, it has started to become a problem in surface waters and even in certain areas of groundwater. And so I thought it would be a good idea to have him tell us his approach to how chloride treatment and removal is possible with these modern technologies, to give us an idea of another resource we could use for alternative groundwater or water supply. So Peter Cartwright was nice enough to join us today. He entered the water purification and wastewater treatment industry in 1974. He has his own consulting and engineering firm since 1980. He's the technical consultant to the Canadian Water Quality Association and has provided consulting services to more than 250 clients globally. Cartwright has authored approximately 200 articles, written several book chapters, presented more than 200 lectures and conferences around the world, and I would guess after this year that's probably more like 300. The recipient of several patents also. He provides extensive expert witness testimony and technology training courses. Cartwright holds a degree in chemical engineering from the University of Minnesota and is a registered professional engineer in this state as well. Please help me welcome Peter Cartwright.
Thank you, Ole. I'm going to use a lavalier because I tend to pace when I talk. And I'm really happy to be able to fit this lecture in. I came back from Houston last night, and I was, of course, a little bit apprehensive about even getting out, equally so getting in on Monday, but everything worked out. So I got back here late last night. Fortunately, I had prepared this in advance. But the McElhaney Lecture Series is basically sponsored by at least the money for all of the travel is paid for by Franklin Electric. It's been conducted for a number of years now, and what they do is they select someone for an annual lecture series. Right now, I'm up to, I guess, 38 obligations. The bad news is I don't get paid for it. The good news is that seven of them will be in Australia. So... And I've never been to Australia, so I'm looking forward to that. I also wanted to say, as a graduate of the University of Minnesota and active in the engineering mentor program, I think it's we have a great institution here, and I'm also honored to have my granddaughter, Mari Cartwright, attending today. She's a junior in environmental sciences, and so I'm very happy to hear her talk for the first time. Have her hear me talk for the first time, at least about something I'm supposed to know something about. So anyway, unfortunately, I often read these slides, and I'm at a location where I can't read them. But basically, the McElhaney series has been offered by the National Groundwater Association to hopefully provide some expertise to members of groundwater association and associations and water well associations. And basically, it was named after a fellow by the name of McElhaney that basically started National Groundwater Association. and the current executive director is Kevin McRae. And what they do is the various organizations, and this is the second organization I've spoken to in Minnesota. The other one was the Water Well Association. I might also add that I try to be casual. We have a lot of people in the room, so, and I'm limited on time. I try to squeeze 2 hours out of these, but they wouldn't give them to me. I try to be kind of casual in these, and if anybody's got any question, if you can ask it when you're thinking of it. If you're like me, you have an outstanding memory, but it's extremely short. So I encourage anybody. I realize you have a big group here, but and also I have a lot of business cards with me, but I also have a flyer that is out on the National Groundwater Association table out there. Dave Schulenberg, who is the NGWA person here, has them on the table. So if you want to pick anything up, because what I say at all of these lectures is that if you ever have a question, and I can answer it by email or on the phone without spending a lot of time on it, I don't charge for it. I'm not like an attorney. I don't turn on the meter when the phone rings. So I do encourage, and you might think I'd be inundated by questions and phone calls, but I'm not. So I do welcome that if I can be of any help. So what I'm talking, the general area that I was asked to talk about by NGWA was groundwater contaminant treatment technologies. I couldn't drill a well to save my soul, but I like to think I can at least suggest how to treat the contaminants coming out. And what has happened, let me go back a little bit before we get into the specific contaminants that do come out of well water. These are some data that I got from the government about total groundwater volume in the world. And in the U.S., groundwater supplies about 15% of the U.S. population. And probably the most significant thing, at least in the area that I talk about, is that the EPA drinking water standards do not cover any of the contaminants that are in private well water. I forgot to say, I was going to put a little humor in here. I got this from one of the regulating organizations in Utah, showing what can go wrong. And these are real life situations. I also have to add this because I think it's also a little bit humorous. Now, with my vast experience in well drilling, that's probably what I would do. And then these, for those of you who are technically inclined, you might take a moment to read these. This is some very profound scientific. That's about as much as I know about well drilling. So let's get serious now and talk about some waterborne contaminants. With regard to the U.S. Geological Survey, they have done some, and they do it all the time, sampling of quote, typical wells, and they determined that 23% of the wells they sampled had health-related contaminants. Some of the contaminants we have in our groundwater are not health issues, like hardness and iron. Interestingly enough, for those of you who are not aware of it, normally the sister of iron is manganese. Well, the EPA now is seriously looking at manganese as a health-related contaminant. So it probably will eventually end up on the primary drinking water standard list. So it's no longer just an aesthetic or a secondary standard. Of these 23% wells that had health-related contaminants, 80% were naturally occurring. You'll notice that I updated that slide and put manganese on it because I think ultimately it will be on the primary list. Arsenic, radon, and a number of other naturally occurring contaminants. And the other 20% are human influenced. Nitrates, solvents, pesticides, and one of the things that I'll be talking about in a moment is chloride, which is chloride is a naturally occurring contaminant, but the issues we are having in areas like this, and I gave a similar lecture like this or on this subject to the Maryland Delaware Water Well Association. They're concerned about chloride contamination of groundwater. Now, I may be preaching to the choir on this, but the EPA, with regard to Safe Drinking Water Act, has two basic standards. They have the primary standard, which are those contaminants that have been associated with a health issue, and the secondary standard, which are aesthetic. And they're usually expressed in milligrams per liter. For those of you who are knowledgeable about the field, very, very commonly, they measure contaminant concentration in parts per billion, micrograms per liter, and now they're looking seriously at parts per trillion. These are what they call the PCPPs, personal care and pharmaceutical products, or endocrine disruptors. I know that Minnesota's taking a serious look at them. To my knowledge, today, none of these PCPPs have been linked to human health issues. However, as I stand here, I'm pretty adamant about saying I think they will be. It's just a matter of time. And boy, is that going to open up a treatment issue. Virtually any surface water supply is, well, in parts per trillion, it's full of PCPPs. What is a part per trillion? It's about 1 second in 32,000 years. So it's only recently we've had the analytical tools that are sensitive enough to measure that. But we and most of these contaminants are a relatively large molecular weight organic compounds. But that's not the subject of my talk today. I'm just throwing out a concern. So the primary drinking water standards are constantly evolving. The EPA is challenged or required, mandated by Congress to develop, and I can't remember the numbers, X number of standards per year or per 4 years. And what we're going to see is constantly new chemicals that are going to be placed on the primary drinking water standards. Now, the National Groundwater Association has 12 BSP, which are best suggested practices. These are documents that go into great detail about the particular contaminant and then how it can be treated. And they're very, very good, and they're free to download. These are constantly evolving. I'm working with a group at NGWA now that's looking at adding lead. Surprise. And so the point is that these are evolving as well as the primary standards. These are the current ones now. Iron and manganese are together, as I indicated earlier. Strontium, boron, arsenic, uranium, fluoride, nitrate, perchlorate, radon, methane, hydrogen sulfide, and microorganisms. When they asked me to be available to talk about these, I said, oh, fine. I can talk about all 12. It'd be about 500 and some slides. How many hours can I talk? And they said, well, you're lucky if you get 2 hours. And so what I've had to do is go back to each one of these organizations and say, what are the contaminants of concern in your area? To narrow this down a little bit. So let's talk about road salt. Get to the main topic of this. Basically, it's chloride contamination. Why chloride? Because chloride is a very corrosive element. And for example, state of California has a law that, if I interpret it correctly, basically says any entity, any municipality within the state can outlaw self-regenerating water softeners. Because as you know, virtually the only way to soften water, to remove hardness from water in a residential environment is a water softener. Don't ever believe that wrapping a wire around a pipe and sending electricity through it will soften your water. It doesn't work. But so this, what's called sodium ion exchange softening, is de rigueur as far as residential water softening. The good news is it does produce soft water. The bad news is it contaminates the hell out of our environment. We have been depositing countless tons of salt into the environment as a result of water softening regeneration. And so if a municipality in California outlaws residential water softener and, of course, incurs the wrath of all the residents, what they often do is a water conditioning dealer will put in what they call exchange tanks. They would just put in the resin, freshly regenerated, into a house after a week or two or whatever on a periodic basis. They'll come and take the tank of resin out, replace it with a fresh tank, and take it outside the city limits and regenerate it. Well, California's gotten real about this, and they're starting to outlaw that too. So their whole motivation was the fact they wanted to reduce the chloride concentration in their wastewater treatment systems, mainly because of corrosion issues. They also want to regulate control the TDS, the total dissolved solids concentration. So a characteristic of hardness, for example, is it's extremely insoluble. It will form a precipitate at about 11 parts per million. So that is a challenge with regard to scaling, et cetera. On the other hand, sodium chloride is just the opposite. Sodium chloride has a solubility of about 260,000 parts per million, so it's extremely soluble. As a result, is you can't use a precipitation technology to remove it. And today, and I have to admit, I'm not very objective because I've spent 42 years in the membrane industry, but on a practical basis, from an economical standpoint and an efficiency standpoint, reverse osmosis is virtually the only technology of choice. Now, I'm a very, very strong believer in point of use drinking water treatment with reverse osmosis. I'm not going to say that you need it, but Flint being an example, you never know what's in the water. Back in the day when I had children very young and grandchildren very young, I insisted on having a point-of-use drinking water system, under-sink reverse osmosis system in my house. They are the insurance that I think that everybody should have. But I'm not selling, I don't sell anything tangible. I probably installed 300 of these at friends and relatives' houses in my career, and I will tell you as I stand here that I measure the quality of the reverse osmosis membranes whenever I go to somebody's house for dinner or a visit or something. I try to bring along my conductivity monitor That may be the only reason they invite me, but anyway, I've got one unit in the Netherlands that is now starting to fail. The membrane is reducing in its percent rejection. It's been in for 20 years, and I've never done anything to it but check it. So, and I've say, as a result, I would say the average life of these membranes is about 10 years. So they are very, very good technologies. We have membranes today that are outstanding. You can't get 100% rejection of salts with a membrane, but you get 99.8%. Pretty good. So let's talk about membrane technologies and the point of use application is just kind of an aside. I won't be mainly talking about that, but it's the same technology. These are the advantages of reverse osmosis. It's a continuous process. For those of you who are engineers and know the difference between a batch and a continuous process, water softening is a batch process, filtration is a batch process. When you run as much water through as you can up to the point at which it plugs or doesn't work anymore, then you've got to take it offline and do something with it. Theoretically, reverse osmosis operates. It's actually one of four technologies, and they're called cross-flow pressure-driven membrane separation technologies. The ultimate one is reverse osmosis, and that's the one that we're talking about because it is the most effective for removing chlorides. Anyway, theoretically, they run forever, and you never ever have to do anything to them. Yeah, right. They do foul, but in theory, they will run for long periods of time before you have to do anything with them. Low energy. The only, you know, in the scientific world today, there are no free lunches. I guess I get one today, but So energy has to be put in to affect some sort of separation, regardless of the technology you're using. With regard to these cross-flow pressure-driven membrane separation technologies, the only energy is pump, pressure. It's the pressure that forces water through the membrane and holds the contaminants back. They're modular design. You can go from as small as a 2-inch by 12-inch membrane for a undersink unit up to a four foot long by 16 inch diameter membrane, which are the largest they make normally for seawater desalting or very large systems. The largest seawater desalting system in the United States now has only been online since December. And it's at Carlsbad, California. It's desalting the Pacific Ocean to make drinking water, and that's 50 million gallons a day. So they're modular. Minimal moving parts. The only moving part in a reverse osmosis system is basically the pump, whatever's supplying the energy. There's no effect on the form or chemistry of the environment. As a result, membranes have been around since the middle 50s, and they were first put into production in terms of applications in about 1960 or so. And one of the early applications was cheese whey processing, taking cheese whey from a milk processing or cheese processing plant, separating the lactalbumin from the salts and lactic acid and other contaminants in the whey, and recovering the lactalbumin as a source of protein. So here's an opportunity to take a wastewater material and extract something of value. Because the membrane doesn't change the phase or the form of the contaminant, it doesn't oxidize it, it leaves it as the chemical that it was when it started. All it does is concentrate it. Is a discrete membrane barrier with reverse osmosis. There's not universal acceptance of the mechanism of rejection. I can get into that in a little more detail later, but the point is that if it's one of the other membranes, the other two of the four are do work strictly on sieving. What's too big, they're like a filter. What's too big to go through is going to be held back. But this membrane barrier does accomplish something. And there's no chemical addition requirement to affect separation. Typically, these a large water purification system will have anti-scalant addition and maybe pH adjustment, but that's only to minimize fouling of the membrane. But you don't need chemistry to affect the separation. And so it's ideal in terms of its environmental application. Now, typical dead-end filtration, 100% of what you have. Okay. If this is the medium, and I'm a little anal about English, if it's a filtration media, that means it's more than one medium. So if it's a singular medium, it's a medium. If this is the medium, sand or whatever, and you run water through, in filtration you run 100% of the water through, and hopefully everything you want to remove is either left on the surface or down inside. With cross-flow filtration, and notice that when I described what these were, I said they were cross-flow pressure-driven membrane separation technology. This requires the feed water coming in with the suspended solids or dissolved salts, whatever you want to remove is in the feed water, goes between actually two layers of membrane in reality, and what you're doing, and the important thing about membrane separation is you don't do anything to the salts or contaminants. All you do is extract water. It's only a water removal process. That's what happens. This whole area is under pressure, and on this, what I call the concentrate stream that's exiting the system, there's always a valve or an orifice on there to create back pressure because this feed water comes in from a pump usually, and so it's under pressure. But the back pressure is created by a valve or orifice downstream. Therefore, this whole area is under pressure, and part of that feed water goes through the membrane and is purified. The membrane has the ability to purify it. Those of us in the membrane industry get our undies in a bunch when you call them filters. But if it's easier to understand, think of it as a filtration process. You are extracting water from a feed stream. And the four kinds, there's microfiltration, ultrafiltration, nanofiltration, and reverse osmosis. I'll go through these rather quickly because of lack of time. But as far as microfiltration, by my definition, I'm in the process of attempting to write a book after this year when I don't have to lecture so much on these technologies. And so because I'm the author, I get a chance to choose definitions. And the definition I use for microfiltration, the industry tends to use pore size. And I say, no, that's too inaccurate. I talk about application. If you're going to remove suspended solids from a feed stream, you use microfiltration. It has the ability, it's got pores in the membrane that have the ability to hold back suspended solids. Meanwhile, macromolecules, which is the chemist's term for dissolved organics, go through, and salts go through as well as water. And so, by my definition, microfiltration is particle separation only, suspended solids. The pore sizes are typically less than about 1 micron, and the removal mechanism is sieving. What's too big to go through is going to be held back. Ultrafiltration has somewhat tighter pores, usually made out of exactly the same polymer, just with a tighter pore design. And so these pores are tight enough to hold back many macromolecules, dissolved organics, depending on their molecular weight, as well as suspended solids, so that theoretically only salts go through as well as water. And so the definition of an ultrafiltration membrane, it's the removal of dissolved organic materials. On a commercial basis, my experience has been that the tightest true ultrafiltration membrane on the market today will reject macromolecules, dissolved organics, with a molecular weight above about 1,000. If you want to get tighter than that, then you have to go into some of the other technologies. The pore sizes are typically smaller, of course, than MF. Otherwise, you couldn't remove these dissolved organics. And again, the removal mechanism is sieving. So these are true filters by the definition. And nanofiltration, to understand nanofiltration, you have to understand reverse osmosis. Nanofiltration selectively removes dissolved salts. And for those of you who haven't had much chemistry, I apologize in advance, but the multivalent salt is a salt that has more than one charge on it. I don't care whether it's a negative or positive charge. An example is calcium, magnesium, aluminum. They have multivalent charges on them. Or sulfate, carbonate. They have multivalent charges. So those are preferentially removed by nanofilters. And the monovalent salts, those with only one charge, tend to go through. And because I don't get paid by anybody in the industry, I can be as insulting as I want. And I noticed we have a GE guy, John Peichel here, and he'll probably discuss it with me afterwards. But anyway, back in the day, in the early day when they were just discovering, as it were, nanofilters or trying to find an application for them, nanofilters were reverse osmosis membranes that didn't pass quality control. They weren't strong enough as far as their rejecting capability. Then they found out they could be used for municipal softening. Because with softening, you want to remove multivalent salts. So all of a sudden, they said, oh, we're going to start marketing these, you know, poor quality control membranes. Now they make them with separate technologies, and there is quite a business out there for nanofiltration. So NF is loose RO, rejects salts, but only multivalent salts to any degree. Normally, you get different nanofiltration membranes with different properties, but they can be as high as 95 to 98% of multivalent salts and as low as 10% rejection of monovalent. So they have a place. Keep in mind that for each one of these four technologies, the larger the pore, the more readily water will pass through, the lower the pressure. So they're less expensive. So if you want to remove salts, but you don't have to remove 100% of the salts or close to 100%, you can use nanofiltration, which is a less expensive technology. But for reverse osmosis, we have to understand osmosis. And we could not exist as living beings. Plants couldn't exist. Trees couldn't exist without the phenomenon of osmosis. And basically, if you have two solutions here, one with a low concentration of salts and the other one with a high concentration. And the problem you get involved with in trying to describe this is you're using counter terms. Low concentration means it's high energy. The higher the purity of water, the more energy it has, the higher its energy state. So if you have these sitting here, these two solutions separated by a semi-permeable membrane, what will happen is that the water will go from the high purity side. It will try to balance the energy. So water will move through the semi-permeable membrane into the low energy or high salts concentration, dirty water side, and raise the level. And that level, because that level, you're going against gravity, so it creates pressure that's called osmotic pressure. And if you put, if you create a system out of this, you pump the water into the dirty water side. As it exits the what I call the concentrate stream, you've got a valve there to create back pressure. Now you'll force water back into the pure water side. And that's why it's called reverse osmosis. It's osmosis in reverse. And here's the illustration. Here's the membrane. Salts are rejected, macromolecules are rejected, suspended solids are rejected, and water goes through. And then to put all four of these in perspective, this is what they look like. Now, this is a busy slide, and I think, will these be available to for download? If anybody? Oh, okay, good. Then I won't go through this in detail. But this, what this does is summarize the properties of the membranes in all four of these technologies. And wait for you to finish your photograph. But this is the rest of it. And the way that that these membranes work, or the way they're made, and today, virtually 100%, not quite 100, but virtually 100% of all of the reverse osmosis membranes on the market today are thin film composites. What they consist of is a backing material, which is usually a nonwoven. Normally, a polysulfone polymer layer is coated on top. And polysulfone is one of the primary polymers used in MF and UF. So you basically got an MF or UF membrane here. And then you deposit this extremely thin layer of a very, very special polymer that has the ability to reject salts. And it's called interfacial polycondensation. There are different names for it. But the bottom line is that this very thin layer is what does the rejecting. The rest of this is just to give it some support and strength. So the capabilities, the reason why these, and back in the day when I got into the business, I worked for a company that made membrane elements and systems. Same company that ultimately morphed into General Electric, and that's John's employer right now. But at that time, the membrane of choice was cellulose acetate, vastly inferior to this. This was invented back in about 1983. And what makes these so special is they have high salt rejection. As I said earlier, they have them now on the market that will reject 99.8% of the salts. Excellent thermal stability, 140, 150. As a matter of fact, the membrane will take a higher temperature than some of the materials that are used to construct the membrane. It's bacteria resistant, and it's very pH stable. They claim, some of them claim they can use them up to between a pH of 2 and 11. So they're very stable chemically. However, the Achilles heel, as I said earlier, there are no free lunches. The Achilles heel of these membranes is you have a terrible time trying to disinfect them because virtually all of the disinfectants today are oxidizing agents. And an oxidizing agent will attack the membrane and shorten the life. Now, some of the manufacturers say, well, you know, we got X number, 10,000 ppm hours. In other words, 10,000 ppm of free chlorine, for example, or 10,000 hours of 1 ppm of chlorine. But my feeling is if you're going to design a system, you better take the free chlorine out or any other oxidizing agent. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to disinfect these systems as a result. Again, back in the day when I first got into the industry, formaldehyde was the disinfectant of choice. It's a fantastic disinfectant. It's not an oxidizing agent. It's a reducing agent. Unfortunately, it attacks people. So it's been basically outlawed as a disinfectant. But in terms of its efficacy with the RO membranes, with the thin film composite, it's very, very good. And then they're available in four different configurations. And I won't spend much time on this except to say that this is like a heat exchanger or a filter press. This is basically a tube, hollow tube as big as 1 inch in diameter with a membrane coated on the inside. It's made out of a plastic, usually, or a ceramic that is porous. And so in all cases, these are under pressure. So they will tend to force water through the membrane. Hollow fiber, which is not made by casting. The rest of these are just casting on a flat sheet. This is made by extrusion or a spinneret technology. It's a little different technology. And then the workhorse in the industry. In terms of RO, I would say, although you can get this and this made with an RO capability, about 99% of all the membranes on the market are spiral. So we're going to talk about that. And again, I can be insulting because I don't get paid by these guys. The analogy I use for a spiral wound element is like a double roll of toilet paper. It's seamed around these two layers of the membrane-coated backing material that are made in, let's say, 40 inches wide, and they have adhesive seals on both sides, so they're sandwiched together, and then at the third side across, and then they're wrapped onto a porous tube that has perforations in it, called a permeate tube, and what happens is the water will pass through. I don't think I have another slide. Oh, yes, I do. Okay. The water will pass. This is the feed water going across the surface. But keep in mind, this whole thing is under pressure. So the some water will pass through one layer of the membrane, and there is a melamine-coated fabric on the inside between these two layers that just helps collect and facilitate the movement of the permeate. But once this water has been purified, it collects in here, and then it wraps around in a spiral configuration. It travels in a spiral configuration down into this tube, this permeate tube. It goes through the holes and comes out one end or the other. Meanwhile, the concentrate, this is the feed coming in here. I don't like the term residue flow, but I usually put the arm on various manufacturers to let them give me their slides. This is actually what I call a concentrate stream. You have extracted a certain quantity of water going from one side to the other, or one end to the other. And in a housing, they all have to be in a housing, because you have to hold this spiral. Keep in mind, you can be feeding this with 1,000 psi pressure. So you have to contain that wrap, that spiral configuration. So it's inserted into what we call a pressure vessel, which could be stainless steel or fiberglass reinforced polyester. This is examples of it, and actually it isn't all the sizes. There's a 2.5-inch membrane, 2.5 diameter, 4-inch, 8-inch, and 16-inch, and they're all, the industries tended to standardize on 40 inches long. And then you can put as many as 8 of these in one vessel connecting the permeate tubes together. And this is the primary reason why everybody is using spiral RO is because it is so inexpensive, because it is an extremely competitive business, very competitive. So because everybody that makes spiral ROs manufacture them to compete with everybody else. So they can all, you can have a system with maybe 1,000 of these elements in it. They call them membrane elements. And a competitor can bid on that and get the job, and his will fit right in the same one that the previous manufacturer had used. So they're extremely competitive. And the terminology, the feed or the influent, what I've been calling concentrate is also called brine and reject. The permeate can be called product. I never see dilute, but it's listed as one of the terms, or filtrate. And then they're put together in an array or a bank. Now, I'm not going to go into the design necessarily, but one of the characteristics of this is that RO will reject a percentage of the salts it sees. It's not absolute like water softening or ion exchange. It doesn't remove 100% of everything that comes in. Like I said, it can go up to 99.8%. But it's a percentage of what it sees. And therefore, the higher the total dissolved solids, the higher the conductivity of the feed water, the higher the TDS, or the conductivity of the permeate. In other words, if you have a 99% rejecting membrane and you feed it with 1,000 psi, I'm sorry, 1,000 parts per million or 1,000 micromoles per centimeter of feed water. If my math is correct, the permeate would be 10 psi. But if you fed it at 10,000 parts per million, and keep in mind they have these things operating on feed water above 50,000, if you fed it with a feed water of 10,000, the permeate would be 100. So the higher the conductivity, or the higher the salts content of water, the lower the quality of the permeate will be, because it's a percentage of what it sees. But the way it removes dissolved organics is by size exclusion or sieving. The as I said earlier, an ultrafiltration membrane may remove organics down to about 1,000 Daltons, 1,000 molecular weight. The RO membranes today will work at somewhere between 100 and 150 Daltons. So they're much, much tighter. The trouble is they also reject salts, and you may not want them to. But what's too big to go through the membrane is held back. They are more or less absolute as far as their removal of organics. They're not as far as their removal of salts. And the ability to filter something out is going to be a function of both the size and the shape of the organic molecule. And this is what a system might look like. If this is a single membrane or a system, you have the feed stream coming in here. This is just an illustration of what the membrane, where it would be located, theoretically. What goes through the membrane and is purified is the permeate, and the volume, the flow is Q sub P, and the concentration, whatever you're trying to remove, is C sub P. And then the concentrate is what does not go through the membrane. It comes out, and the back pressure is created by the valve. The most important thing on this slide is the definition that is very commonly used, and it's really something that is one of the first questions you have to answer in designing a membrane system, and that is recovery. Because you have the control. If you're designing a membrane system, you can put in any recovery you want within reason. And recovery is that percentage of the feed water volume that goes through the membrane and comes out as permeate. And that by itself only addresses volume, relative volume, volumetric things. So the percentage of feed water that passes through the membrane and comes out as product water. It's also sometimes, or it used to be called, efficiency. And it's just simply the permeate rate, flow rate, liters per hour, gallons per minute, divided by the feed rate, and then you convert it to percentage. And I give a course very often on how to design a reverse osmosis system, a four-hour course. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people that come to that course that can't even remember how to convert from decimal equivalent to percent. They have to be reminded. They've been away from high school math for a while. And now what happens? Why is recovery important? Because keep in mind that this whole phenomenon of reverse osmosis is the removal of water from a stream, not salts. But when you remove water from a stream, you increase the concentration of what's left behind. It's like using evaporation. If you evaporate 1 liter of water, if you have 1 liter of water on your stove and you evaporate 50% of it and you condense it and recover it, let's say that's your permeate. Now you're left with half a liter with the same concentration of salts, or the same quantity of salts that you had to start with. Well, what have you done to that concentration? You've doubled it, right? This is an extremely important fact to remember. And so what happens if you take and look at changing the recovery, increasing the recovery on a linear basis, this is what happens to this concentration factor. How many times it's increased. If you've got, 75% recovery, which means that 75% of the water that has gone through this, 75% of the water goes through the membrane and becomes permeate. Now you have theoretically all of the salts left behind in only 25% of the water. So what have you done to their concentration? You've increased it by a factor of 4. You'll notice this goes up exponentially. And keep in mind that, as I said earlier, that the percent that the quality of the permeate is going to be a percentage of what the membrane sees. If you increase the concentration that much, then the quality of the permeate is going to go down. The advantages of running something at high recovery is you have a lower flow rate because you're extracting most of the water that's in the feed stream. So I have smaller diameter piping, smaller high-pressure pump. But the disadvantages can be profound. You can exceed the solubility of something like calcium or magnesium or barium or something like that, and they can foul the membrane. Osmotic pressure, which we haven't really talked about, definitely haven't talked about, but that's osmotic pressure is basically, in simple languages, it's the resistance of a particular solution to being pumped through. For example, with seawater, average seawater, 35,000 parts per million, you need 400 psi of applied pressure to get your first drop of membrane, of permeate out of a membrane. And that is directly the result of the osmotic pressure of the seawater. So if you start increasing the concentration, because osmotic pressure is directly related to concentration, if you double the concentration, you're going to double the osmotic pressure. So you can have a high osmotic pressure for high recovery, or you will have, depending on what the salt is that's in the water. As recovery goes up, permeate, total dissolved solids go up, and there can even be some discharge issues with the concentrate. Keep in mind that with this technology, you don't make the contaminants go away. You just put them in a smaller volume. You dewater them. You increase their concentration. So you still have to discharge. We already talked about that. And one thing that many of the people that get involved in designing reverse osmosis systems seem to forget, that water going through a membrane has a very significant viscosity issue. Cold water is much more viscous than warm water. And each one of the manufacturers has a temperature conversion chart that tell you what the effect is on the membrane rate. For all intents and purposes, although that's not a completely true statement, it only affects the permeate rate. And for example, here in Minnesota, we have a lot of cold water. For example, all of these membranes, you buy a membrane from somebody, it'll tell you what the permeate rate is at a given pressure, at a given concentration of salt in the test water, and at a temperature of 25 degrees Celsius, 77 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, there's not a whole lot of water in Minnesota that's 77 degrees Fahrenheit, particularly if it's well water. So you're taking water out of the ground, it may be 37, 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And just as an example of how that affects the permeate rate is a generalized statement. But for example, at 50 degrees Fahrenheit, the production rate, the permeate rate, everything else being equal, pressure, salt concentration, everything else being equal, that has dropped by 37%. And normally when it comes to water purification, if somebody's taking water out of the ground and they are challenged with producing X number of gallons a minute of permeate, and they don't factor in the temperature, they can get themselves in deep doo-doo with the client who says, gosh, you know, you were going to give me 100 gallons a minute. You're only giving me 70 gallons a minute. Whoops, I forgot about the temperature effect. So this is really profound in terms of the performance of the membrane. And it's because colder water has a higher viscosity when you're talking about these tiny. The purists say that reverse osmosis membranes don't have pores. they have voids in them, but they're not true pores. But whatever it is, this higher viscosity water requires more pressure to get to go through. And this is a kind of a typical temperature correction chart. But, and the pump pressure directly affects the permeate rate. If you double the pressure of the pump, you're going to double the permeate rate. So the first comment would be, oh, why doesn't everybody build an RO system that operated at 1,000 PSI? Because you're going to foul it in a heartbeat. The bane of all membrane systems is fouling. But as the pressure goes up, the permeate rate will go up. And this is kind of an array. You put these things together with the, here is the feed, this is the concentrate. You pull the permeate out in parallel. And because you have less water, less concentrate leaving these than you had going in, or the flow rate is less in the concentrate stream, then you use have to use fewer membranes. It has to do maintaining turbulent flow in these things. On a practical basis, RO cannot produce 18 megohm. 18 megohm quality is the highest ionic purity of any water production on a commercial basis in the U.S. You can make it up to 26 megohm, but not on a practical basis. You can't make 18 megohm water just with RO. You need to follow it with polishing technology such as ion exchange or electrodeionization. So, you know, but RO is so inexpensive compared to these other technologies that it's a two-step process. First, you use RO to go as far as you can. Evaporation, I haven't talked about that at all, because although it's used for zero liquid discharge, again, you pre-treat it with reverse osmosis. Fouling is the bane of all membrane systems. How much time do I have, Ole? 5 minutes? Okay. I'll go rapidly through this. Fouling, like I said, every single membrane, the Achilles heel, is fouling. I don't care what kind of membrane. There are four different kinds of fouling. It can be from just suspended solids, from things like calcium carbonate precipitating, from organics that coat the membrane, or biofilm. Some people say that biofilm development on a membrane is the greatest cause of fouling. And solubility, this just gives you some idea of some of the solubility limits. These are examples of what the fouling materials are and what the mechanism of fouling the membrane is. Now, one thing that I do want to point out is the difference between, and this goes back to the McElhaney lecture requirements. There are two ways to treat water. You can treat it at the tap, point of use, and as I talked about, the undersink ROs, which I'm in love with, and point of entry. Treating all the water. If it's a water softener, for example, you want all the water in your house to be softened. So that's point of entry. If it's arsenic issue, you could treat that just at the tap, because the only time you have a problem with arsenic is if you ingest it. If it's lead, you can still just treat it at the tap, because lead is only dangerous if it's ingested. On the other hand, if it's Legionella bacteria, which if you inhale it, you'll get legionellosis, then you have a point of entry issue. So it depends on what the contaminant is and what the health implications are. For a point of use RO, the way they work today, you can buy these things. General Electric makes the point of use ROs that are sold by Home Depot. $179, you can get as good an RO system as anywhere available, period. They all contain pre-filtration, some sort of a pre-filter. Then they basically should use, I can't even spell hardness. It's amazing what you learn when you get up. Okay. Normally, the water for a point-of-use RO should be softened water. So, for example, if you were going to put one in your house and you discover that you don't have softened water in the kitchen, I would strongly advise you change the piping so you do have soft water in the kitchen. because otherwise the hardness could eventually scale or will eventually scale the membrane. But it should use soft water, but the membrane system has a sediment filter built in and a carbon filter built in ahead of the thin film composite. So, and going back to the PCPP issues, nothing will remove all of the PCPPs. There are too many of them. They're too varied. But the two standard technologies used in undersink reverse osmosis, activated carbon and the reverse osmosis membrane, go an awful long way to making the water safer. Do you need it? That's a debatable issue. But will it help, in my opinion? Absolutely. And this is what they look like. But I won't spend much time on this because I don't have time. But basically, I am done. If anybody has any questions, feel free. How much time do I have, Ole? 30 seconds? Or? All right. If anybody has a question, ask it. Otherwise, I'm going to hang around. Yes, sir. I guess. Sorry? Oh, okay.
We're Minnesota now is approaching the process of permitting some sulfide mining. Of course, we're hearing a lot about reverse osmosis, and you mentioned something today about fouling the membranes. Now, once you foul your membranes, can you flush that out and rehabilitate it again, or is your reverse osmosis module done for once you fouled it?
No. Every reverse osmosis system design, the number one design factor is to minimize fouling. You can't prevent it, but you can minimize it. If you catch it early enough, if you maintain your system properly, it's possible to mitigate foulants early enough. There are all sorts of ways you can, depending on what the foulant is, but yes. Yeah, but the downside of the spiral membranes is of all of those four membrane designs, they are the most susceptible to fouling. But we can still go a long ways, particularly with pretreatment ahead of it. So you design everything with pretreatment in mind.
So the typical mining installation will require pretreatment before you hit your reverse osmosis.
Absolutely. I don't know much about the mining process, but I can make a blanket statement that if you don't pretreat an RO membrane, you're asking for trouble. Yes, ma'am.
Maybe I missed something not having a lot of chemistry background, but what do you do with the concentrate? How do you dispose of that?
That is an interesting challenge. It all depends upon what the concentrate is and what can be done with it. When I'm working with a client, and I do an awful lot of wastewater, that's my favorite topic, is wastewater recovery and reuse. One of the very first questions I asked, once he or she learns about the advantages of membrane technology, is I say, what can you do with the concentrate? And in many cases, if it's a wastewater system, the recovery, for example, you notice I pointed out the effect of recovery on the concentration of the permeate. In many cases, the concentration of the concentrate stream resulting from a certain recovery will affect its ability to be reused. And so, likewise, if it's a wastewater system, if we're not talking about drinking water, if it's wastewater, again, your design factors will be a function of how you can reuse the water, for what purpose. And in many cases, it's difficult to get the client to understand what you're getting at and to make a decision. But you have the ability to control all of these factors generally. Well, thank you very much